name's Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest was described to me as an inspirational and impressive leader of men. An incident in Afghanistan led to a traumatic brain injury that was to change his life forever. This conversation is brutal, honest, and extremely emotional. Episode 39, Stuart Hill. This is Declassified. Why was you born in West Berlin?
Because my dad was stationed there. And that, so that would have been 71.
How long did your dad serve?
He would have done 26 years or maybe 28 or whatever. So it was a full crusade. So he went in as a soldier and then, you know, 18 or whatever it is, and then went through the ranks and left as a LE officer captain.
What was he in?
Queen's Regiment.
Which is now?
PWRR Regiment.
Do you remember much being a military child?
I don't. Not really. I mean, the odd occasion, I remember being loving the fact that we lived on an army camp, and because there was security everywhere, that my mum and dad just let us roam free. And we, you know, and so we could just go out and play soldiers all the time and spotlight. I remember actually, it's nothing to do with the army, but having torches and playing spotlight where you had to chase each other, and if you got caught with a spotlight, that's it, you're dead. And next, and you know, just being a kid.
How old was you when your dad left?
I think I was 12. He left, and he wanted a small holding because my dad grew up on a farm, and he wanted to have some animals, and my mum had horses, and they wanted to go riding a lot. So it was a case of, okay, they need some land. They can't afford that much in Sussex or anywhere in south. So where's a cheaper area? Wales or Scotland, because my mum's originally from Glasgow, and they chose Wales because of the cost of the housing. So we moved to Pembrokeshire. So I'd been an army brat, and I had been messing around and had loads of friends at school or on camp, and then we moved to Manachlogdi, and I remember waking up. So we arrived, we were in the car, and we arrived, and there's snow everywhere, and we lived on the top of this mountain, and it's pitch black, snow everywhere, it's bloody cold, and the car couldn't get up the gravel track. And so we then had to carry everything, all our baggage and everything, all the way up to there. And I woke up and opened the curtains, and all I could see was this big valley and about five houses dotted around. And then, I was English as well, going to a Welsh area. Mm. And so that was, although I was never bullied or anything like that, but there's a lot of piss take for being English, for being a Saesnik. Which is one of the first words I learned when they said, "Oh, go and ask the teacher. Toichtbin Bob Sais." It means, you know, I don't know what's 1 + 1 or whatever it is. And toicht. So I very enthusiastically miss. Toichtbin Bob Sais, and everyone laughed because it means arseholes to the English or fuck the English or whatever. It's just derogatory.
Was you clever as a kid? Did you do well at school?
I wasn't intelligent. I wasn't clever.
Was school the right place for you to learn academically, maths, science?
Yeah, it was. I mean, on reflection, looking back, and I felt it's always been a lost potential. I may be false in saying this, or just created this image, which wasn't the truth. But I remember actually when I was in the army. Sorry, when my dad was in the army, I passed my 11 plus, which in those days was a big thing, and I was only one of two in the school to pass, which could mean that the school was thick. I don't know, but I passed, and so I had the opportunity to go to grammar school. They didn't have one in Maidstone, and you couldn't join a grammar school until you were 13. So my dad said, "Do you want to go to boarding school?" Because that was available and with the education grant and all that. And I said, no, I don't want to. I look back, if I want to rue the day, that's when I thought, actually, I think I could have done well at sport and stuff like that. Mm. If I'd gone to a school that created that, allowed that culture.
Was you into the arts? Was you into...
I loved... I did. I mean, I loved painting. I loved... younger, when I was about 11, I remember writing to an actor then called Gordon Jackson. He was in The Professionals, and he was my idol. And because we had to write a letter to your idol or someone you wanted to be, and I wanted to be an actor. Mm. So I wrote, and he wrote a nice letter back saying, if you want to be an actor, you should go to RADA. and Ross Rada. And then I also remember Star Wars coming out and The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi and just being fixed on those and just drawing all of the characters from that all the time. And I loved O-level art. It was my favourite subject. But they didn't have A-level art. So it's like, what do I do? And the careers officer said, okay, well, we think you should do maths and history because you're good at those as well. And so that's when I think I lost my passion for art. I didn't know what I wanted to do in my life.
Yeah. You did then go to a uni, a polytechnic.
I went to a poly, yeah. Bristol Poly, which is now a university of West of England. Did business there because of my A-levels. And again, it was the advice from the careers officer to maybe go into business. And so thought about, okay, working in the bank or being an accountant or whatever it was. And then just hated it. And it was so boring. So after the first, so I did the year and I hardly went to any lessons or anything like that. And then had a summer job waiting to then return to a place that I didn't really want to go back to. And I had the results from my exams and I failed two of the six exams. So I phoned up and said, when is the resits? You know, and they said, what's your name? Stuart Hill. Okay, let me check. Oh, let me get back to you. Okay. Stuart, your attendance at this course, at this college is so poor, we don't think you actually want to be here. We're not allowing you back. And those were the days before it was a business.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, right, okay, what do I do now? Find a job, I suppose. And again, I still wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And then spent, I was unemployed for a bit. I was working in the leisure park for a bit. I did some voluntary work with the Prince's Trust and working in Tesco's. And as well, I was at Tesco. So I was about 20, I think 21 now, working in Tesco's on a break and reading a paper where it said that the British Army was struggling to recruit officers, which made me then start to think, actually, let's go back to my childhood. What did I enjoy doing? Yeah, I'd enjoyed soldiering. I enjoyed that environment. I enjoyed being an army brat and being around that, and thought, actually, I don't want to be a soldier because my dad was a soldier. And I was brighter than him. I say that with all respect, of course. But I thought, actually, I don't. But not just because of whatever level of intelligence I had, but I thought I wanted to be around, I wanted to command soldiers or try and lead soldiers or whatever it was. Because I had very small responsibilities in the leisure park or at Tesco's, you know, and wanted to be responsible for people.
Was your dad proud?
The proudest I've ever seen my dad was when I nervously opened the letter on the top of Mlanachlwy Mountain, opened it from Sandhurst, expecting them to, sorry, not from Sandhurst, from the regular commission boards, which is you have to do a three-day board there to see if you can select it, and opened it up and it said, I've passed, you're going to Sandhurst. And that's the proudest I've seen my dad.
Who did you join?
So I wanted to join the infantry, and because I wanted robustness, I wanted to do sport, I wanted to not fight as in go to war, but I mean just do...
to be a soldier like he was when he was a kid,
yeah.
Playing.
Yeah. Yeah, it was that. Mm. And thought, okay, I don't want to drive truck, I don't mean like that, but you know, I wanted to do proper soldiering, what I thought was proper soldiering, which it was. And it was important to me to join my local regiment, which was the Royal Regiment of Wales. And I remember having an interview with the colonel of the regiment when he's going, right, where are you from? Where did you go to school? And what A-levels? And what sort of income, you know, that sort of your family have? And so it's like, oh, sorry, I went to a comprehensive and I'm not that bright. And okay, we'll accept you anyway, or whatever it is. So I remember getting a loan out because I had to have a suit and I had to have certain things to go to Santa's with. And I'd never had a suit. And so took out a loan, £1,000 loan, and started buying all these clothes on the, you know, the clothing list. And these are things that I would never have said a few years ago, not a few years ago, 10, 20 years ago, because I didn't have the confidence, which I have now, to say, actually, that was who I was.
Mm.
I wasn't publicly school educated. I had a Marks and Spencer's suit, and it was different. And yeah, I'll stop there. Yeah, so went to Santa's. Loved Santa's. I loved it.
You went Northern Ireland, Bosnia, Kosovo.
Yes.
What was your experiences from those tours?
I mean, they were all benign tours. We, unfortunately, when I got commissioned, and the battalion were out in Northern Ireland. It was at the time of the ceasefire. So, oh, it's disappointing. But then the ceasefire broke, and we went down, spent 3 months down in South Armagh. But again, it was fairly, there was non-violent. There wasn't that much activity. Bosnia then in 2000. Yeah, 2000. You know, the millennium.
Mm.
The year 2000, everyone's woohoo! It's because, you know, the year 2000, everything's going to crash. And I had the flu. I was stuck in a Koromek in Bosnia. Everyone, the rest of the officers' mess were having a little party with limited booze, of course. And I was there feeling really sorry for myself, thinking, this is a shit millennium.
Yeah.
And then a month after that, I had timed my R&R perfectly to go home for the birth of my first child, Olivia. And we were worried because I'd arrived 6 or 7 days before the due date. And then come on, you need to be on time. You need to be on time because 2 days after I'm flying back to Bosnia. And thankfully she came out. And this is where I'm a bit of an idiot sometimes, is Melissa, my wife at the time, as I think a lot of pregnant probably women were, was worried about her fitness and maybe her belly or whatever it was. And at that time, the ab rollers were just coming out. I thought, okay, my wife is worried about losing her six pack or whatever. Ab rollers are really effective, apparently. I'll buy her one of those for a gift. So the gift for my wife after giving birth, after a 36-hour labor, there you go. There's an ab roller.
There's an ab roller.
Which was never opened.
Yeah.
And never accepted. Yeah. and then Kosovo. Kosovo in 2001. And again, the violence had stopped and we went out as a peacekeeping role. And I call that my paper round tour because although I was a recce platoon commander, we're now armoured. It was about peacekeeping. It was about information management. It was about whatever the terms are. I've forgotten how to use a military terminology. But we ended up distributing the S4 paper and engaging with the locals. And so, yes, there was... Am I proud of... I should be proud of those medals. But medals for me should be about, I don't know if I'm saying this the right way, a real war. I think, I'm not sure.
Were they just boring for you? Were those tours boring?
There was elements of boredom, but I wasn't craving war, but I don't know. No, I wasn't, I never did. But also, the way I describe it is, it's like being an actor that you are rehearsing all the time for this play. Training, everything about is about this play. But you never have the opportunity to put it on stage for whatever reason, because the money's not there or whatever it is. And then when you are said, right, okay, we're now going to perform. It's going to be on stage. You're going to be excited. I can now prove whether I can act, whether I can perform. Mm. And that's what it was like when I had the opportunity to go to Afghanistan. It's like, actually, now I'm going to be on stage. Let's see actually who I am.
Well, let's move us to Herrick 6 in 2007. You went with the Mercians.
Yes.
So you went there as a company commander.
Yeah.
What was that tour like for you?
So 2006, that was a busy tour. It was very violent. I took over the company halfway through. So I took over the company in the end of July, I think, of 2006. And the guys they were battle weary. They'd been pushing up and down the Upper Goresh Valley, clearing, working alongside the Grenadier Guards. And so by the time I got there, they'd captured a place called Rahim Calais and had divided the company up into three locations, which were then responsible for the security of the area and stopping the influence of the Taliban, who were just across the line on the map. And so it was about defeating, deterring the enemy. And also we had overwatch over the Helmand River because they were using that as a lot of resupply crossing the river to one of their bases. I'm using probably the rubbish words, but one of the enemy bases to the south of the river. I arrived to take over a company of 100 and whatever guys who didn't know me. I didn't know them. We'd never worked together. And I remember the first conversation I had with the company sergeant major. He said, "Sir, the guys don't want you here. what? He said, they're nervous about you being here. I said, why is that? He said, because they had just been fighting really hard for the last few months. They're really, really tired. Lance Corporal Sanford, who was a very keen and popular member, competent member of the company, had just been killed the week before. They were becoming scared. And they said, we're worried. The guys are worried that you'll just want to come in and fight to earn a medal, to do what they were so enthusiastic about to begin with, and then realize the reality of war is quite different from, you know, actually performing that play is hard work and can be terrifying and exhausting. And they were at that stage where they didn't want to have to. And they also didn't know what I was like. They didn't know my capability. I could have been completely incompetent from their perspective or whatever it was. So that for me was a challenge. So I thought, okay, well, how am I going to deal with this? I need to speak to them. I just need to tell them the truth. So I got to visit as many as I could, as quickly as I could, and said, guys, this is who I am. This is where I'm from. This is what I'm about. This is my experience. But guys, I've never been to Afghanistan. You have been out here for 3 months. I don't know everything. I'm going to be coming to you for advice. I want your input. And I did. And I spoke to the soldiers and I got the junior commanders involved in my future planning and all the rest of it. But I said, we will achieve whatever the mission is. And if that mission means that we've got to fight every single day, then that's what we're going to do. And that's what I will do. If it means we never have to fight again whilst we're here, we won't fight again. And I said, please just trust me on that. I'm here to do what we are required to do. And they believed me. And I stuck to using them. And they trusted me. They became very trustful of me very quickly. I told that story to a Times journalist who visited a couple of weeks later. And then I was really quite annoyed when then on the headline on the article said, Major Hill says he has no desire to fight the Taliban.
Oh, really?
Like, no, that's not what I said. Yeah. I said, if I don't need to, I won't.
Yeah. Did that bond become strong with the guys on the ground?
It did, because I've always been an officer that is... I'm not saying other officers are different, but I'm very happy to get down and dirty with the soldiers. Mm. They're not my friends. They've never been my friends. But so a little thing. So I,
you don't have to be friends with people to have bonds.
Correct.
And also in a position of command, you know, leadership's so important, as well as keeping distance so you can make good judgment. Because I think it's really important to differentiate between, you know, especially high stressful pressure situations like you'd have been in as a company commander, and the difference between that and a lance corporal or a corporal on the ground. But you was on the ground with the bullets.
Yeah. I'm not all the time. When we did company level operations, or whether I wanted to go out and explore with them, as in, you know, wanted to know a particular area, so I would piggyback onto their patrol or whatever it was. But the, you know, the first time we had a contact, for me, they'd experienced it many times, but it was just so loud, and there was lots of RPG, rocket propelled grenades being fired and machine guns, and just had a, and in fact, because they had ambushed, because it was in the summer of 2006, up at the Upper Gresh Valley, so the corn fields were above head height, maybe 10 foot high, so it was like jungle type environment, and they had ambushed the company, and a soldier had just been shot in the stomach, a couple other minor type of injuries. And so there was that going on. There was the contact, and it was just noise. And I was trying to sort things out, trying to stay, well, I was calm, because I made a point of always trying, forcing myself to just stay calm on the radio. But I remember that one of the platoon commanders had to grab me, said, sir, come on. They're firing at you. Come on. You need to go. It's like, what? Yeah. I was oblivious to it.
Yeah.
Because I was focused on trying to do my job.
Was that because you weren't acclimatized to the situation?
Yeah. It was that. It was complete. Bloody hell. This is no amount of training can ever prepare you for that real first explosion and contact and the sheer ferocity of rounds going past you, hitting walls around you or whatever it is. Mm. And the returning gunfire from your old soldiers as well. Mm. It was...
Are you on foot?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, infantry, so we'd just walk everywhere. No, I know they had vehicles out there as well, but we didn't. We did all our patrols on foot. And so I suppose trust from my... how I dealt with that particular on that particular operation, my reaction to that probably worked in my, well, it did work in my favour, so they could see that how I didn't go to pieces, so they could actually see that I was okay in combat. So I'd earn my wings or whatever, and we just built, when you're in situations where actually you're being shot at every day and you're fighting, there are elements of your company fighting every day, you know, we didn't, the facilities in 2007-06, sorry, were basic. We had to dig our own shit pits. I'm not saying, oh, poor me, but it was a case of, right, dig a big hole, get an MFO box or a cardboard box. Let's create a sitter so at least we can sit down on something. And it was out in the open. So there were three holes in this box that we'd put over this this hole in the ground. And then we'd just sit there and have a crap or whatever in front of anyone and everyone that walked past. One of the amusing ones was when I knew that one of the senior NCOs, Sergeant Fitzgerald, I think it was, had been desperate to go to the loo, desperate. And he goes, I've got to go. So he rushes off and then comes back a couple minutes later. I thought you were, yeah, I just sat down. And when that bloody female, because we had another journalist with us, female reporter comes along and she sits with me and starts doing one herself. It's like, I can't handle this.
Yeah.
And so he says, I'm going to have to wait until she's done. But she was fine with it.
Yeah, I can't relax it.
Yeah, exactly.
Paper out.
And that was it. It was a great tour. And it was great, and we loved it, and we were so happy then when we got back and we had no further deaths, which of course is great, and no serious casualties, and then it was a case of decompression, doing other tasks. You know, you're now being, okay, we need to send a range team off to Belize, or you need to provide a platoon to do public duties, or a platoon to do whatever. And so then we're just doing that for a few months, and then it was pre-deployment training and ready to go on Herrick 10 in 2009.
Was that all the same? Was that the same company?
Yeah. So for me,
so a very quick turnaround, 18 months, something like that, 2 years.
Yeah.
Which was normal.
Which was normal then. Yeah. It was. It was becoming more and more frequent. And so, although I'm jumping ahead, so we did the 2007-2009 tour. I was injured in 2009, so I left. But then, you know, I would ask about Corporal so and so, whatever, how's he doing, you know, the star of the company.
But let's go to Herrick 10 2009. You're taking the blokes out now from fresh, you've got the trust of everybody.
Yep.
Was it a different feeling then going out with the group?
It was an understanding of how hard it could be, and therefore what our training needed to be to prepare people for that robustness. And so the training was a lot harder and was more specific to Afghan, more specific to the experiences that we had encountered, as opposed to, you know, the standard first aid course that we had, or the shooting practices or whatever it was. It's very specific training. We also had soldiers who hadn't. So there was a bit of, whether it was jealousy or whatever, or intimidation, but you had guys who were hardcore, you know, they'd been to Afghan on this tour, and then new soldiers joining in, they hadn't been to Afghan, they hadn't had their medal. And so is also talking to them. We also had some TA, because we were short of manpower, so we had some territorial reservists join us, and it's incorporating them into the company. So our final exercise, confirmatory exercise, was on Salisbury Plain in January of 2009, in 3 foot of snow.
Okay. Similar.
And in 2 months we're going to be in 30 degrees heat or whatever it was. But nothing actually prepares you for that stifling intensity of that heat and that sun when you're out there. I mean, you said you've been to Iraq, and so it'd be similar. You know, it's just a different ball game. It's just, this is hot.
Was you, because I know you guys move around a lot as company commanders and the officers. Was you going out there for the full tour?
So in the way that I took over halfway through the tour, I was due to leave halfway through the next tour, because just a certain rank of officers, when you're major, you change your appointment every summer, every 2 years. And so, but the brigade commander said, for continuity, he either wanted all his company commanders to do the whole tour or leave before they'll do none of the tour on voluntary basis. And so I decided easily decided that I was to stay, that I was to do the whole tour. It was so important for me to be with my soldiers that I had been with, loved, and I don't mean that in a perverse way, and I don't even mean that if someone said, do you love your soldiers? I think subconsciously I did. I just wanted to protect them, wanted to be with them.
It's so important. The responsibility to us.
Yeah. And so I said, I'm doing the whole tour. I didn't tell my wife. Because I didn't want her. I didn't want her to say I don't want you to go, because I knew I would refuse that request and say I'm going.
Well, how had it changed? 2 years is a long time. How had the training changed pre-deployment? How had when you had arrived? What was you facing that you hadn't faced, you know, 2 years earlier? Had your approach changed?
Not my approach to leadership, because it was the same as it's always ever been, which is about engaging with my soldiers, which is about treating them as people, which is about having conversations with them, being open, and providing them with what I think is really important is that soldiers. I'm generalizing, but soldiers, if there's a lack of information and there's an information vacuum, as I would call it, then people fill it. And they will usually fill it up with wrong information and negative information. So I felt it was always important when I felt they needed to provide them information. So I would, if there were big decisions that I made or was going to make, I would tell them why I made the decision. I was never asking for their approval, but I would say, this is a situation. This is the decisions I'm faced with, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to do it because of this. Whether you like it or not, this is happening, sort of thing. And I know they always, because they've told me, they said, we may not have agreed with your decision, but we knew that you thought it was the best one or whatever. And so we're very happy to support that. And that's actually what leadership is, just engaging with people, explaining with people. How did it change? It hadn't. We went straight down to a place, Garm Seer. We took over from, I think, the rifles, and we were fighting on day one. Sorry, I laugh with my ex-company sergeant major, Paul Muckle. He's an LE officer now. I was laughing with him. He didn't find it funny, still doesn't. But on the first day that I took over, that we had command of the area of responsibility or area of operations. We had, prior to that, on the handover final day, we'd identified an IED, improvised explosive device, about 300 meters on this track from our patrol base location. So we did a big operation to clear that. My company sergeant major, Paul Muckle, and my FU, college, someone Owen Candy, that's it, were chatting just off the track. And then they started pointing their rifles, looking through the telescopic sights or something. I said, what are you doing? And they said, we think we're being observed. And as soon as they said observed or dicked, whatever the word was, there was an explosion between them. And they just disappeared in this rubble and this clay and whatever it is and smoke. And it's like, fuck. And it was close. I mean, it was between them. It was great relief when they then both started stumbling out of it. And stumbling sort of towards it. And thankfully, because the ground was so hard that it just forced the explosion in a very narrow spectrum, but straight up. Although there was a lot of dust and debris and all the rest. Anyway, the funny bit was, not necessarily immediately, but the company sergeant major, he's confused and it's like, come on, calm down, no, it's all right, try. It's like, quad bike. And there's, because he had a quad bike, he gets on his quad bike, he's trying to drive away. And there's a big Land Rover in front of him and he kept driving into the Land Rover, like, sergeant major, come on, off. No, quad bike. Come on.
3 months in, the incident happened, and can you tell me about the build-up to when you were blown up?
Okay, so we were down in a place called Garm Seer, and then it was decided that strategic level, political level, that the US wanted to do a big push. 2009 was the year that they were going to clear the Taliban out of Helmand Province forever. 30,000 extra Marines came in. to allow the British and the Danish forces to then to then move out of their holding areas, or whatever they were military they're called, to then go and do this big operation called Panther's Claw, Panchai Palang. So everything now was about the build-up for that. And the area that that I was attached, my company, B Company 2 Mercian, was attached to the Light Dragoon Battle Group, and the task for them was to clear this area. I've forgotten what it's called, maybe Nadi Ali or something like that. But it was believed that there would be about 350 insurgents. It's a big logistic area for the Taliban, and they needed to cut off that and supply. And the Welsh Guards had already started doing their bit. Rupert Thornlow, the CEO, had just been killed. And so, I mean, so everyone was preparing for a proper fight. I remember the night before, Company Sergeant Major came up, and it was good to have someone to take not control of me, but to guide me a lot. And so he said, "Sir, you need to speak to the guys. Why? You need to speak to them. We're about to go to battle tomorrow." And they had been told the day before by someone of a higher rank. I won't say who it was, because of the impact it has on the soldier. They said, "Guy, you know, we're about to do this Panchai Palang, biggest operation ever taken place in Afghanistan. It was. There will be deaths. Some of you will not come back." And you can see the look on the guys' faces. Although they'd been fighting for 3 months, they don't want to hear that. They don't want to be told. They know that my guys might die. And so I was aware of that. And that's when Paul Markle said, "Look, you need to speak to them. Just speak to them." So I did. And again, it was from the heart. And it wasn't about logic. It wasn't about statistics. It was just about pride. It was about how proud I was to be there with them, to be with them on this fight that's about to happen. Never once mentioned casualties. It was just about we have done this together. My bristles on my, I can't really remember the speech, but I know on Facebook comment, which is a delight for me, when guys still now say, I'm not patting myself on the back, but it's nice to get recognition from soldiers. Mm. And when they say that was such an inspirational speech, that was such a great speech for us, and you know, but the irony is I was saying how proud and we're going to fight alongside together, and this is going to be a hard, tough couple of weeks. I only lasted the next 12 hours.
What happened?
So it was the 4th of July, and so our part in this battle group operation was to clear this area, and the brigade, under the brigade sort of staff direction and planning, we were to clear 3 kilometers a day. We crossed the Nadi Ali Canal, and 20 minutes after crossing, my forward right platoon, commanded by Jem McElveen, got into a firefight. Then there was a firefight over to the left, and the ANA, Afghan National Army, over to our left flank. There was an ID explosion, killed a soldier, and several other injured. And for the next few hours, there was always an element of my company in a firefight. So what the enemy were doing, we're doing delay into that tactics. Because again, around the canal, so a lot of irrigation ditches, a lot of crops, a lot of agricultural land. And so the area, the ground is split by all these irrigation canals. And on each of these canals, because of the... I've forgotten what the word is. The water and the ability of... So this is crap way of saying it. I sound thick. Trees were growing and grass was growing. Mm. And so the enemy would be hidden in wherever it was and delaying tactics. So every time we came out of one tree line, they would engage us from another tree line, the next tree line, delay us. There would be a bit of a scrap or whatever they would try, and the enemy would try and come round. And so there was this non-stop-start fight. And... it was slow, it was ponderous, and we had travelled about 400 metres in about 6 hours. And then suddenly there's an explosion of machine gun fire and individual explosions of rocket-propelled grenades, and I look over to my left immediately because that's where the sound is coming from, and there's a tree line, and black smoke just disrupts the clear blue sky, and almost immediately... I hear over the radio from Guy Disney. Guy Disney was a troop commander that was attached to me. So he had three scimitars and he was a troop commander and he was out on my flank. Almost immediately I heard over the radio, Zero Alpha, 2-0 Alpha, contact, casualties, I need a heli, I think I've lost my leg, over. And I could hear the screams of my soldiers in the background. And it's just, fuck, this is real. That was, this is real. And it was just also that, you know, all these immediate thoughts. Another thought was, I can't believe that this platoon commander, Guy Disney, who I had only met a few days before, I hadn't really got to know him because he was just become attached, he's trying to control the fight that he's just had a leg taken off him. So what happened is that the enemy, the Taliban had ambushed them. Machine gun fires, rocket propelled grenades, and one of the rocket propelled grenades. So what it does is it sends a piece of copper, which turns into a molten slug pellet, about 4 inches long, 2 inches wide, something like that, and it travels through the air at 200 miles a second. One of these penetrated Guy's vehicle at an insecure spot or whatever, a weakness, went straight through the vehicle, straight through Guy's right leg, taking it off below the knee. And then embedded itself in the chest of 19-year-old Private Robbie Laws, who was the ECM man, killing him instantly. I remember I met up with Guy again recently, and he was saying that, you know, it's just mayhem. And he said, I looked out, I was trying to work out what's going on, and I didn't know Robbie had been killed, but there are people lying around, and I looked down, my leg was sort of hanging off, and then I lost control, and what happened then is a troop sergeant took over. So I'm not aware of this at the time, but I'm aware that a troop sergeant has taken over because I'm now talking to him, and we're talking about how we need to extract these casualties, where we're going to extract them from, how we're going to get to them, what is the best plan. But Guy recently said, what was really annoying is when they tried to get me out of the vehicle, my leg got jammed somewhere and they were ripping the bit of the left. I still had a bit of, it was still connected slightly, and they were pulling it off. Like, stop. Not quite stop, but you know. My memory's not great over this period. Talking to Owen Candy, the forward air controller, needed helicopters in, so there was a request for helicopters. Then after 20 minutes later or whatever it is, I hear the distinct waka 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 sound of the Chinook helicopter. Look over to my right. It's accompanied by 2 Apache attack helicopters, which was so grateful. They were such an asset out there. When you knew you had an Apache, you felt really safe because they could see so far ahead and do so much damage to the enemy that were trying to kill you. So that added security straight away. Call to my company sergeant major. He threw a smoke grenade. Orange smoke goes up, disappears as a Chinook helicopter banks round. The tail ramp is down. There's a gunner on it. We've secured the area. We've moved around, and the casualties are being dealt with to the left. And I'm at this stage, okay, I can't be distracted by that. I need to be focused on what we're going to do next once the helicopter's gone, because we are way behind now. We need to be clearing 3 kilometers, and it's nearly the end of the day, and we've only gone 400 meters. And so I then watched the first body being taken on, the first stretcher, and I can't see Guy's face because the distance is about 200 meters, or 100, whatever it is, 100 meters, no, it's Leah. But I know it's Guy because there's this ragged shape of a leg that's hanging off the side of the stretcher. Behind them are some walking wounded, and then I didn't know it was Robbie Laws at this time who was killed. I knew a soldier had. I was aware of the ZAP number, which is the identification of the individual who's the casualty. And then watched a stretcher with a sheet over it and feeling, what was I feeling? I know I felt really, really sad, really sad. And I also remember thinking that, shit, in a few hours' time, there'll be someone in a suit and tie, a casualty visiting officer, who will be knocking on someone's door, telling them that soldier, you know, as I said, I didn't know it was Robbie, that Robbie has just been killed. Oh, shit, I'm Jeez, I'm sorry.
It's all right, mate.
I haven't reacted like this for a...
It's all right. Just take your time.
Still recording, sorry.
Yeah, so I will edit all that.
No, you, I mean, keep it, I mean that genuinely, because if people are to understand, I'm not ashamed of crying anymore. I'm not ashamed of showing my feelings. That was completely unexpected. I've never cried once in probably 8 years discussing that, and I don't know where that came from.
When we're on mics, when there's two of us on mics, yeah. It can... evoke a lot of emotion. It's a weird situation when
you're
really focusing just on voice and the actual story instead of everything else. You know, yeah. When we chatted yesterday in the art gallery and this distraction and go through automation. But when you're actually reliving it, it's really powerful and it does evoke
bloody hell. Okay. So thinking of someone who would be knocking on someone's door, and then the helicopter flying away. And I remember also feeling really hungry. My stomach was hurting and I was dry in the throat, but it was like, okay, no, what are we going to do? We need to do something. What are we doing next? What do we do? We need to keep going. And then that's my last memory, is watching a helicopter fly away. So everything after this I've been told or read about. My company sergeant major, Paul Muckle, apparently he called me over to, because he wanted to discuss, he wanted to know what my plan was, what are we now going to be doing? And so we are chatting apparently, and Lance Corporal Dennis, who was attached also, he was a light dragoon, walked past us, and he stood an improvised explosive device which killed him instantly. And that was an IED that was of low or no metal content. So we had cleared the whole, because that's where I sited my tactical headquarters. And before we were going to work from there, the whole area needed to be cleared with mine detectors. And it was. And loads of people had been walking backwards and forwards because of the mayhem of what just happened. And that was the headquarters, and people were coming backwards and forwards with information and all the rest of it. Lance Corporal Dennis just happened to stand on, I don't know, that one square inch or whatever it was, that ID, and it killed him. And then it smacked me in the back of the head, so the shockwave punctured both of the eardrums. Shrapnel from the blast smashed through the back of my brain, and my company sergeant major was knocked out unconscious, my air controller was knocked out unconscious, my radio signaler knocked out, so people have said that it was just, we dealt with this casualty and thought, oh, right, now. And then suddenly mayhem erupts. And then they look and they said, they're just bodies spread all over the place. Thankfully, no one, apart from Lance Corporal Dennis, who I've just mentioned, thankfully no one sustained loss of limb or anything like that. It was probably miraculous, I don't know. But so again, this is not from a memory. So shrapnel through the back of my brain. I was found somewhere, I don't know where, but several meters away. Someone else was taking charge now. One of the platoon commanders had to try and deal with the situation. Helicopter call back again, a different one. So they had to come back and pick up other casualties. In fact, at this stage, I've been told they didn't know that Lance Corporal Dennis had been killed because they didn't see a body, because the explosion was so big. Apparently it left a hole that you could fit a Ford Fiesta in. The explosion was so good, it sent his body is about 40 meters away and into trees and overgrowth and undergrowth or whatever the word is. And so they dealt with the casualties that they could see. New helicopter comes in. I'm one of those casualties. And then when they have a bit of respite, then they go, okay, let's do a name check. blah, 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 Lance Corporal Dennis. Where is he? And then they look in the hole, do a bit more looking or whatever they were, sorry. And they notice in the ECM battery, and he was an ECM carrier. And it's like, fuck. And there's blood and stuff. And so they then put out a search party and they find him, apparently. And Lance Sergeant Collins finds him, and there's a relevance, there's an important part of why that's his name is important. So he finds his body, and he said, he was barely alive. And he said, I held him for 10 minutes and he died either there in his arms or died on the helicopter in his arms. I'm not quite sure what. Lance Sergeant Collins, with that incident and the day after I got injured, when Dane Elson was killed, Lance Sergeant Collins killed himself a year later. Fucking hell. Sorry for swearing. So I'm then extracted. And trying to keep it very quick and simple. So I then flown back to Camp Bastion, where they decide they can't do it. They don't have neurological facilities, so they just need to sustain me, to keep me alive. So I'm then transferred from Camp Bastion to Camp Kandahar, where they can't operate on me again. They don't have facilities. We need to just keep them alive if we can. And then I've flown back to QE Hospital in Birmingham. Meanwhile, my wife, Melissa, receives a knock on the door at 1 o'clock in the morning on the Sunday. So the 4th of July was a Saturday. And she's told that your husband, Stuart, has suffered a very serious head injury, and we don't expect him to live. And that's all they did say, all they could say, I don't know. And so she's like, any other injuries? We don't know, because in the signals that they send, they can only apparently, or I don't know if they changed, but only send the most severe injury. So I, in theory, I could have lost legs or whatever it was, but the brain injury was the most severe. Anyway, and then I'm not saying that because leg amputations are so much. Sorry if that came across like I didn't mean to.
No, I think you understand. The most severe, severe
injury. So then she receives that knock on the door. And so she's dealing with a thought that I had had in my head a few hours before when I was thinking of someone else, and now she's having to deal with it. And she said it was horrendous, not just that, but horrendous because there was no follow-up and no one came back to her and said he's still alive or he's not. And so it was about 6 hours as she was at home. She's like, who do I do? And so what do I do? I need to know, is he dead or not or whatever it is. And so she phones up a friend of ours who was still in the army, and actually he had just got back from Afghan the week before, and he was on his R&R. And then Sid Wellham receives a phone call to say, could you help me out? I don't know where Stuart is, what's wrong with it, you know, blah, blah, blah. So then he gets involved, and so he gets another visit and another update. So she's then told we're going to fly him back to the UK for surgery. We don't know if he's going to survive the flight. They had to apparently land the plane twice to alleviate the pressure on my brain, and then I'm in hospital, and Melissa meets me. I've got no memory of any of this, and she said it was bizarre because your whole head was wrapped in bandages, but everything else of you was untouched. You had a six pack, you were tanned, you know, you just looked from their neck down angelic and sort of, I don't know, she just looked not perfect. Yeah. She said it's so bizarre. And then she then had to sit through the surgery, not knowing whether I'll survive that, and then was told, okay, he survived, he's going to be okay, but we've got no idea of what the damage is going to be on his brain. So there's a lot of ambiguity for my wife to deal with, a lot of unsure. So she didn't tell Olivia, my first daughter, who's 9 at this stage, told her that daddy had been, what'd she say? Told that daddy been hurt, but should be okay. But she didn't tell any family or friends apart from her mum and dad and uncle. But that was logistically to get them to come and babysit so she could go to the hospital. Because she said from her perspective, she wanted a definitive statement to give. Either Stuart's been injured and is alive, or Stuart's been injured and is dead. She didn't want to say he's alive, but we're not sure. And so she wanted clarity. And so when she got that, then she was able to phone around. It was other relatives found out because it was in the Daily Mail, because I had happened to have embedded journalist team from the Daily Mail, Richard Pendlebury and Jamie Wiseman, and they were attached. And so they had recorded it all, and it was a really good scoop for them, I suppose. But I've become friends with Rich, and I know actually he hated that time. But then it was published. There was a few articles, and one was published, and distant relatives said, that's how we found out, by reopening it up and going, bloody hell, she has been severely injured. Lance Corporal Dennis was killed. The forward air controller who was attached last minute had permanent nerve damage to his arm, and the rest of the guys had some hearing loss, concussion, but all recovered fairly quickly. So that was that day. But I've got no memory of it, and I'm glad about it, but I'm also inquisitive. So, for example, reading Dead Men Risen about the Welsh Guards, because we had a Welsh Guards fire support group attached to my company throughout the tour. So when they were talking about this particular element, they mentioned me, Major Stu Hill. They spelt my name wrong, but it said Major Stu, described the explosion, said Major Stu Hill then was found with a radio antenna embedded in the back of his skull. Mm. Like, was I? I didn't know that. I don't know if that is true or not, but I like to tell that story now. But what did certainly happen is shrapnel went into the back of my brain, and I've still got two pieces there, which are a millimeter away from my brainstem, which, I mean, they're tiny pieces, but it was too dangerous to take them out. So I was induced coma for 6 or 7 days, I think. And then once they knew physically, neurologically, that I would be okay, they took me out of the coma. Then I've still got amnesia probably for the next 3 weeks.
What is your first memory coming out of it?
I'm not sure. Mm. It doesn't say memory stops. It wasn't like that. I remember some things, and I'll describe one of them. So I remember a visit from a couple of army guys, Shav Gilby and Phil Kimber, who had served with and stuff like that. And so they came to visit. What I remember them is them taking a piss out of me because of the bandage on my head, that I was talking like a fucking idiot or whatever it is. And I remember them taking a piss out of me. And I had a chat with Shove about this a couple of years later or whenever it was. And he said, I remember you taking a piss. And he said, we didn't know how to deal with you. We didn't know what to do, so we just went to that default setting of just take the piss out of you.
It was always been dealt with as a traumatic brain injury.
Yeah.
So it's always been that side of things. And I suppose when the lad's legs come off, you understand, like, okay, that's that.
Yeah.
You didn't spend that long at Headley Court.
So I was in the hospital for 6 weeks, then I went to Headley Court for an initial assessment period of 3.5 weeks, and I persuaded them, myself, that I should be discharged.
Which you did, and then went on sick leave for 6 months.
It was indeterminate sick leave. It ended up being 6 months because by the five month period, I was going off the wall because my brain hadn't improved as quickly as I thought it would. And I was confused and I was really struggling. And so asked to be readmitted to Headley Court.
Yeah.
But I was open up then. I was open to therapy. I was open up to rehabilitation.
Mm.
Before I wasn't. It's just, fine, I'm confused, I've got a bang on the head. You would be confused if you just got smacked in the back of the head. Let me get out of this. It's an artificial environment, a hospital and rehabilitation center. I want to get back with my soldiers. Initially, I want to get back out on operations. They're still out there. I need to be out there.
Mm.
Then I thought, actually, no, I'm too weak. I can't go back out there. And then it was, okay, I need to get back to B Company. The hardest thing, not hardest thing, there are many hard things. One hard thing, but I can deal with it, but it's a matter of regret. I never had a chance to properly say goodbye to the company, formally. I met them on their subsequent return, but by that stage, someone else had taken over. And I left in a way that I didn't want to. As it goes back to just bloody loving the soldiers.
When you was at Headley Court for the second time, you had a big stint there. Is it 10 months?
Something like that, 6, 7, 8 months or whatever. It was supposed to be for 6 weeks, and then it was extended, because
And
too many difficulties.
What was the rehabilitation for brain injury?
Some speech language therapy training. So it was, what was it? It was about, I was very paranoid that I couldn't express myself, that I couldn't talk to people, that I felt that every time I was talking to someone that they were not interested in me, that I bored them very quickly. And I, because that is one of the things with a head injury, is it impacts on your social awareness. And so I lost elements of social awareness. I didn't know I was having difficulty with engaging with people. I didn't know what the social norms were, you know, that sort of thing. So I could be abrupt in my thoughts or my thinking and blurt out things. Or not blurt out, but just, but so for a period of time, and it was for a few years, if I had something in my mind, it had become so important for me that I had to say it. Mm. One, because it was important, but two, because I thought it, I didn't want to forget it because I kept on forgetting things quickly. So we could be having a conversation and suddenly I go, well, stop. What was the, I don't know, some random thing. Okay, relief. Now I can continue the engagement or whatever it was. But at that time, for the first couple of years, I could only have a chat with someone for about 20 minutes, maybe less than that because it was just too exhausting for my brain.
Concentration-wise.
Yeah. To have to speak to someone, in a, you know, just chatting like it is now. Mm. Although this has been emotional for me. 20 minutes, that was about the capacity. It just got too tiring, too exhausting to have to think. So that's the part of the speech language. You know, I've got to listen to you and the hearing had gone and stuff. And I, all those subconscious things, all those, what they call automated things that we learn, that we grow up with, and this is how the brain works. You know, once you practice something enough, it, like driving a car, it becomes second nature.
Right, muscle memory. Of
muscle memory and brain memory. Mm. A lot of that I had to relearn again. And so there's one example, which is fairly early on. So when I'm out to the hospital, allowed out for the first time, to see if I could cope with being out of the hospital, taken home, and I'm, my wife helps me go upstairs, runs a bath for me. She has to undress me and she puts me in the bath. And she said, you know, I left you alone because she said, I felt awkward. She said, I shouldn't be undressing my 37 year old husband and whatever it was, place him in the bath. And so she then came back a few minutes later and I was sobbing in the bath. Apparently, I had a bottle of shampoo with me in my hand and she said, why are you crying? I said, because I want to wash my hair, but I don't know how to. And so lost, thankfully, a lot of that came back, but I had to relearn a lot of new things. The real challenge for a brain injury is, it's a hidden wound, but okay, if you've been hit in X spot, it doesn't mean that that particular part is where your brain impairments are going to be. It could be over the other side of the brain, because the brain is such a malleable, such a flexible, such a sensitive area that, you know, bang there and reverberates through. And so for me, my brain impairments are not where the shrapnel smashed through the back of my brain, but in the front of my brain where the force of the blast smashed my brain forward and suffered bruising now, and that's where my brain damage is. So the difficulty is for the patients themselves, for and for the experts, the medicals, is you don't know what the problem is until you encounter one on a frequent basis. So we could say, so they did, they would say, okay, Stu, you've been hit here in your cerebellum, which is the back of the brain. Therefore, from that, because of that, we could predict that you would have problems, because that's the area of the brain that deals with bodily coordination and balance. You might anticipate balance issues, how to coordinate, how to lift your arm, how to do those things. And it wasn't. And so the bruising, I can't remember. I don't think of the bruising. It either hadn't been detected or it wasn't sufficient enough severity for them to really do much with it. Because they actually, physically, they didn't do anything with it. Mm. And so then when I'm starting to have problems, such as planning things and organizing, I'm talking at really some simple levels. Writing an email was such hard work, as in constructing words and trying to work out how to use a typewriter again or whatever it was, blah blah blah, and it uses so much energy. So when I started to have problems which were about planning and organizing and making decisions, it was realized then that actually that's the area of the brain, which is the right frontal lobe, which is the executive function part of the brain, which is where the bruising was. So then it's like, oh, okay, actually that's probably where, you know, the impact of that bruising is causing these problems. And then you can start to identify problems and then start to try and deal with it and manage those issues, which you're only aware of once you encounter them. And it's very easy in the first months or whatever it is to dismiss things, problems, because I've got smack on the back of the bloody head. Of course I'm confused. Of course I get angry. Of course I... So would you... And that's what I kept saying, you know, and I was just... I had no understanding. It's not that I didn't want to accept it. I thought it'd be fine. I'd be fine. It's a few days rest or whatever it is. You know, it's that I can do this. I can get through this. This is not going to stop me. This is not going to stop my career. I am robust. I'm resilient. I can work through this. But there was no plan of how to work through it.
You were discharged in 2012.
Yes.
Just before you were discharged, you'd started getting involved with performing arts. That then led, way before that, you'd been invited on a holiday, beg your pardon, you'd been invited on a holiday, you'd got involved with painting and art. That got you into performing arts.
Yep.
You were then discharged. And there was a clear thing that you said to me yesterday, and then again, just before we recorded, and your life was good, but your life was shit.
Yeah. So I had a therapist, because in the week of May in 2010, I had a phone call from Glasgow, which is the Army Personnel Centre, to say, congratulations, Stuart, you've been selected for promotion, Lieutenant Colonel, you're top of the command board, your battalion is available for you to command next year. You know, you can make brigadier, you scored so well, blah, blah, blah. And it was great. And then a few days later, because they needed to know when I could return to work, I asked my caseworker, I said, this is what I need to do, prove when I can go back to work. And she said, okay, let's do a little test. So it'll come to an answer. But so she said, okay, what we want you to do, Stuart, is a presentation on your brain injury. You can decide how long it's for, who it's going to be to, or whatever it is. Just present your brain injury to us. The next morning, after trying to deal with how I even start, I'm crying my eyes out on my bed at Headley Court, knowing that's the end of my army career. I didn't even know. It was just... And so I went back in. I was frightened. I was too frightened to leave my room. I was too embarrassed to leave my room and tell my caseworker that I don't know how to do this presentation. And so eventually I then... I think whether they either came looking for me or eventually, because I was late, I missed the first few hours of rehab, I got there. And I said, I don't know what to do. And I don't know how to do this. And then it was explained, well, we intentionally gave you the task of an ambiguous task with no clarity. We just gave you, you know, this create something because we knew you struggled with making decisions, or we knew you had been struggling. And so it was confirmed then that actually at that stage, my brain was not going to recover enough or in time. And it still hasn't for me to have stayed in the army. I've forgotten what your question was, but...
The question was, life is shit.
Life is shit. So the reason I said that about the promotion is because I would still be in the army now if I hadn't. I loved it. I loved it. And my life changed once I knew that that was the end of my army career. My identity was gone. My life, my role, everything I'd been doing for the previous 16 years had gone. And I felt worthless. And because I hadn't been visited by anyone in my unit when I was on sick leave, hadn't been visited by Headley Court, which they were supposed to do whilst I was on sick leave, I felt abandoned. I hated the army, what they did to me. I hated myself. And I was really, really down. Denial. I'd often go into the caseworker and she would be saying, Stu, we think medication... antidepressants would help with your mood. I don't want antidepressants. I'm not fucking depressed. I'm of low mood. Yes, I feel down, but so would you be. I wasn't aggressive like that. I don't need antidepressants. I don't need them. And I don't, it's just for me, that was for weak people. And I wasn't weak. I can get through this. I have to get through this. And then when I started to think about how I should kill myself, that's when I knew I had to ask for help properly. And so I asked for antidepressants and medication. But the way I used to describe it for a good couple of years after is, my part in my life is shit. What do I mean by that? I mean, I have a house, I have a car, I have a family, I am alive. What have I got to complain about? My role in it was shit. I was shit. Everything else. And so I'm trying to apply logic to it. But you can't apply logic to such a severe, powerful emotion. And so a lot of I'm not saying that's for everyone, but for a lot of therapy, I was instantly dismissive. It's not going to help me. This is crap. Why are you telling me that I should have either positive thoughts or think about things in a different way? I wasn't open up, and this is how the brain bloody works. I wasn't open up to, what was the word? I don't know. I was in a rut, and it was getting worse. And when I'm driving along and I'm thinking, am I brave enough to suddenly turn off? If I turn off now and smash into that wall, there's a good chance I could be killed, which would be a good thing. But if I'm not killed, I don't want to be injured again because I hate being injured. And then it's like, but I don't want anyone to, I don't want actually, and what kept on stopping me was the idea that I would leave my daughter without a dad or daddy, because she was of the age where I insisted she call me daddy. and I didn't like those thoughts. Thankfully, medically and therapeutic terms, or not therapy, psychologically termed, I was never of a level where, I wasn't at that level where people worried that actually I would commit suicide. Mm. These were suicidal thoughts.
Was you planning it? I know you just said that about the vehicle.
I considered options. I didn't actually. So I remember another time on a bus, and I sat on the back of the bus. I always wanted to be alone and on my own. I was ashamed to talk to anyone. I was ashamed of myself, and thinking, okay, if I kill myself, how am I going to do it?
If someone had just said, you cease to exist, would you have taken that?
Yes, absolutely. And so what I concluded was that I should have died in that explosion. And the way I said it, my life would be so much better if I had died. And they're just horrible thoughts. But I don't have those now. I'm aware that I had them.
You had a discussion with your wife in 2014.
Yeah.
About your next step. I think it's probably one of the greatest kind of conversations you've had in your life, about your direction, and then if you take it from that conversation,
really struggling emotionally. I'm on holiday. I'm not sure if you mentioned this, but I'm on holiday in Mallorca. I get introduced to an artist who reminds me that I used to love painting as a kid at school. Did O level art, and I was at this stage because I didn't want suicidal thought. I was right. What can help? What can help me? So I was trying things. Whether it's golf or something or whatever it was, triathlons or, and then he reminded me that I used to like it. And so I asked for a pencil and a piece of paper, and I tried to draw the scene in front of me, the Mallorca mountains, the perspective of the swimming pool. And I was lost for 3 hours. I just didn't have a single thought about myself. All I was focused on was what is in front of me. And I described it as mindfulness in action, although I didn't know what that term was at the time, mindfulness. But that's what it was. I was just completely lost. I didn't have a single negative thought, and I thought that was a time I thought, okay, I can improve, I can get better. And so for that, then over a period of time, over the next few years, I used to use it as a way to escape demons, but not with an idea that this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. It was a tool to help me move forward, but over these 2 or 3 years since my discharge in 2012 to 2014, I tried a job. I had to resign after 9 weeks. I tried to do a degree or open university. I had to stop that because it was just too much for my brain. And things were just not going well for me, for my brain. And I knew what my limitations were, but I didn't know what my strengths were. I didn't know what I was capable of because I was still trying to work out what I could and couldn't do with my brain. And so I sat down with my wife in frustration, not anger, not bitterness, but just frustration. Like, Melissa, I want to work. I do. I was at that age 42, maybe. It's like, I've got a whole life. I'm only halfway through my life. I want a career. I'm still ambitious, but I don't know how to be ambitious. I don't know what I'm going to do. And then she said, okay, Stu, what do you like doing? And I said, well, I love triathlons, but I said, I don't want to be a triathlete. There was a period in time I did a couple of years before, but that nearly ended in divorce, so I had to stop that. That's another story. And I said, well, I said, Melissa, you know, I like painting. You know, I get a lot of pleasure from that when I do it. And she said, well, why don't you be an artist then? But I was reluctant to call myself an artist because I didn't think I was good enough. And so then when I had a commission for a piece of work and had sold a piece of work, I thought, okay, professional, right, I can actually now call myself a professional artist because I've been commissioned, I've sold something. So maybe, yes, I can call myself an artist. I'm an artist. But actually, none of that matters. Because my only identity that I should be proud of is me.
Last night we was at an event which was part of a charity.
Yeah.
I mean, the arts is hugely underfunded, but it was bringing together a lot of people in a lot of different ways. We're at the Invictus Trials in Sheffield at the moment. This is 2019. Okay. For those who are listening,
you should
have
said that at the beginning.
your art is remarkable. Some of that stuff in the room is unbelievable. What is the charity that you're working with?
Charity called Style for Soldiers. So Style for Soldiers originated and is founded and organized and run by a lady called Emma Willis. Emma Willis is a shirt maker, a bespoke shirt maker in German Street, which is in London. She does shirts for they're bloody expensive shirts, but for some very, very wealthy individuals, either in royalty or celebrity or whatever it is, or business. She was aware in 2008 and 2009, because there was a huge number of casualties coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, she wanted to do something. And so she knew that she could make shirts. So she managed to get to Headley Court, and she said it was a bit of a struggle to get accepted into by the MOD or whatever. And she said, I just want to go there and measure up anyone, whatever patient it is, and measure them up. And in 6 weeks after I've measured them, they will get a bespoke shirt. And so her attention was for people who needed bespoke really bespoke shirts because they'd lost a leg or lost a limb or, you know, whatever it was. And so she did that. And she would do that four times probably a year at her own expense or whatever it was. And from that, when she started to talk about it to her clients, they started to give her money and said, we want to help. And then it got to a point where she's collecting this money. This money's coming in. What do I do? I need to be doing something with it. So created a charity, Style for Soldiers. For her, it's all about style. So her intention then from the charity was to, with help from Marks and Spencers, with help from Russell and Bromley and a hat company and all these other things, is to dress a veteran, injured veteran, a Wiz veteran, as smartly as possible. In fact, even smarter than the interviewee, whichever one it is. So that when a person walks into a job, because that's what it was about initially, that they can feel so proud about themselves and so smart that it would hopefully help them get a job and get employment.
Their esteem.
Esteem. And I'll tell you what it is, when you're wearing a 250-pound shirt, you feel so much better in it than in a...
And it's so personal as well. It's your measurements. There's a process that's gone through that. And everything, while I'm up here and everything I've believed in the last, certainly the last 3 years, is this meaningful employment, this pathway, you know, there's an entry point into charities and then the exit. A lot of this exit, people find meaningful employment, and they're the ones that thrive beyond that. And how have you personally been impacted by Emma and what she's doing?
So Emma's done Fantastic stuff. So I was measured up for a couple of shirts when I was there in 2010, and that's how I got to know Emma. And we sort of very loosely stayed in touch over the next few years because my focus was on other things. And then I got in touch with her again because I had a painting that was selected for the Army Art Society exhibition in London and Mall Galleries. I thought, oh, who can I invite? Oh, Emma, she lives in London or whatever. I remember a conversation that I had with her that she did a foundation degree in art. So she came along and we had a chat and we just got to know each other again. And she said, you know, tell me about yourself. And I said, this is me at the moment. I'm trying to paint, but I'm struggling with, I could do with a mentor or someone because I'm not sure about, I need some guidance. So she then immediately knew a friend of hers who was an artist, phoned her up literally there and then, phoned her up, said, would you mind being a mentor for this guy? I know, Stuart. Yeah, of course. So then started that mentoring. And it sort of grew from there, where then through the charity became aware of there's three other guys who had taken up for their own personal reasons, taken up a form of art, art. And so she started to try and coordinate us all and help us. So what she's been doing is they've been sponsoring us. So they're providing us with opportunities such as putting on art exhibitions to show our work, putting adverts into Country Life magazine or whatever it is. You know, she's been helping in her own way. What I really like about Emma and the charity is that they understand, really understand, that people are individual and individuals sometimes need really individual help.
I think
she gets it.
She gets it, and she's flexible and she can work around it.
And she understands that. And so because she also keeps it small, it's only her and her director, Crystal. They together run the whole charity. And so they put a lot of time. She's still got a business. Crystal and Emma run the Emma Willis shirt making business as well as run this charity. And they don't want to employ anyone. They don't get paid for themselves, but they don't want to employ anyone because they don't want to use funds up that they get to be spent on someone doing the job. They are capable of it. And so because of Emma has a lot of networking at a particular level, at a higher level and lower level, you know, but what I mean is she has a big network that she can go to and does go to and is insistent going, I need you to help me. What can you do? So the big gig, which is the opening ceremony, Sheffield Trials on Monday, that was all organized by Emma. Mm. Because she was asked to do something, and Emma thought, okay, what can I do? Who do I know? She knew Elliot, who was the producer. I've forgotten his surname. Kennedy. Phoned him up and said, Elliot, want to put on a musical gig or whatever? Are you happy to help? And he is, and he was. And he said, okay, let me phone up Heather Small and Alfie Bow and Suggs or whatever it was, you know. And it was created. And that was, and then so Emma's like, okay, what else do we need? This is just examples, which may not be the real examples. But okay, we need wine. Who do I know in the wine business? Mm. I need a favor off you. Can you provide X number of bottles? She gets knocked back. Not everyone is always willing and able and wanting to, but the majority of people that she knows does help. Russell and Bromley, for example, they provide footwear, a certain number of footwear to individuals.
Networking is so important. But finally, where can we find your work? Can we get it online?
No one needs to say that anymore, do they? stuarthill.co.uk, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, hill.co.uk. It may not be the greatest website. It's a website, and it's got information on there, and the artwork is on there. I'm on Twitter, stu_art_hill.
I think to see your art is really amazing. Yeah. There's some great stuff and
look online, website.
Brilliant.
Yep.
Sure, we will leave it there.